This is 103.3 KWBU FM. Coming up, a special edition of Behind the Story. On January 28th and 29th, NPR's Wade Goodwin was in Waco for a series of station-related events. Coming up is an entertaining and informative conversation between Wade and Bill Whitaker from the Waco Tribune-Herald, where we learn more about Wade Goodwin. This program was recorded January 29th, 2015, in the KWBU studio.
Hello, this is Bill Whitaker, opinion editor at the Waco Tribune-Herald, and today I'm hosting what we presume will be a wide-ranging, revelatory, and intriguing interview with National Public Radio's roving man in Texas, Wade Goodwin. Mr. Goodwin is here for a KWBU event to show appreciation for the folks that raise funds or donate funds to our local station's unique programming here in Central Texas. And this is going to be a kind of a special edition of Behind the Story. So if there's anything that Mr. Goodwin says that you like, anything at all, please send cash to KWBU. We'll release him from the studio to continue roaming the state, but only if we get enough cash. Wade, welcome to Waco. I know you got here a day ago. What have you been doing since your arrival?
Well, last night we had a dinner with some of the station's key supporters at one of the station's key supporters' houses, and it was lovely. And this morning I spoke to a group of, it was 200 or 300. It was 70.
Well, you know, we journalists are real bad at
it. It seemed like 1,000, I think it was. Yeah, that's the ticket. We did it at the President's Suite at the new football stadium, and wow, I have to tell you.
Quite a stadium.
It's very impressive.
Very, very good. You know, you've been reporting for NPR since 1991, I think, isn't it?
That's right.
You've covered everything from Rick Perry's rise to power to the collapse of Enron to growing tensions involving immigration, legal and otherwise, to our own Branch Davidian siege that erupted about 10 miles east of Waco. And during that time, the media has changed a great deal, particularly in radio. It seems these days that if your chief intent is to accept Jesus, get riled up about pinko commies, or enjoy radio personalities that have something passing for wit, you're okay on radio. I mean, have I got it all wrong?
No, I think you've got it right. I mean, you know, we've all watched with dismay the destruction of print journalism, certainly. Maybe destruction is too harsh a word, but it has been awful to see so many talented writers and reporters lose their job simply because the money's not there to hire them anymore. It's not like the newspaper owners have a lot of evil intent and hate their reporters and just want to fire them. They just can't continue to employ them, because the internet has made their advertising disappear. And I remember when I wanted to buy a car, you went to the newspaper and you looked through long columns of advertising. Everyone had put their ad in the newspaper.
Absolutely.
You know, now, you know, you go to Craigslist. And the reason that public radio has continued to thrive is because our funding model is different. We don't have advertisers. Yes, we have underwriters. But underwriters are a lot different than advertisers. And, you know, for most stations, at least half of the money comes from listeners. And that has allowed NPR to continue to grow and add reporters, while other newspapers have had to drastically cut back. I mean, the number of media outlets that have, you know, thriving full-fledged foreign bureaus is very small now. NPR is one of them. And it's really due to the fact that we're listener-funded.
Right. I think you got it down perfect. One of the things that kind of worries me, and I saw something on your website about citing a recent poll that showed that the most informed people tend to listen to National Public Radio, and the I assume they screwed up and forgot newspapers. But When you go out and talk to people today, do you feel they're as well informed today? I mean, the average folks you do is maybe when you got into this business. We have so much information out there, but I'm wondering if people are actually as well informed. Do you have to explain a lot of things more today when you go out and talk to sources?
Well, I think people are more invested in their own partisan way of seeing things than they used to be. And I think that's, again, we can attribute that to the rise of the internet. People are able to find sources of information that report things kind of that they want to have reported, whether it's Fox News or Salon. You can find your left-wing oriented, you know, internet organization or your right wing. I think that's a problem. I do. I think there's plenty of misinformation out there. I just don't think it's good for a democracy when both sides are so dismissive of the viewpoints of the other side. And I attribute some of that to how we're collecting our information. It was routine for a morning paper or an evening paper to be on the driveway throughout much of the last century. And people sat down, you know, when they got home from work or before they went off to work, and they read the newspaper. And that was a very important way that people got their information that hadn't been digested through some sort of partisan machine. The number of newspapers on driveways is way down.
Right. Well, how did you get into this crazy business anyway?
Well, I mean, completely, you know, it's a second career. I was a political consultant in New York City, and I spent a lot of time in my car driving around from one meeting to another, and I listened to NPR. And this was in the mid to late 80s. New York was a very rough place during that time. and NPR was pretty much All Things Considered in Morning Edition. And that's all there was. But that was a lot. I mean, that was 4 hours of news programming every day. And I turned 30, and I thought, you know, that would be a good job to have.
Well, now, what were you doing up till then?
I was a political consultant.
Did you advise anybody famous? Or?
Oh, no. I wasn't.
Figures.
I did not work for politicians.
Okay.
I worked for a organization of churches, interdenominational churches, who were trying to use the collective churches to hold politicians in New York City accountable to what they wanted to see happen in their neighborhoods. So I trained a lot of pastors and lay leaders about how to use politics to see affordable housing, clean up subway stations that had become.
What made you think you could pull off this big switch into radio journalism?
Yeah, overconfidence.
Overconfidence.
Yeah, hubris, as I think was pretty much it. I organized my way into a series of meetings, and I had lunch with Robert Siegel, who then took me down and introduced me to the head of the national desk, and they said, okay, yeah, we'll give you a shot. I mean, it was a different time. It was 1991. This was not today's NPR. I think today's NPR would laugh me out. One of the things that's happened since then is we have this vast farm system of stations who are training public radio reporters. That really didn't exist. I mean, there were little pockets in Boston and California, but there weren't back then the extensive farm system that exists now, in which public radio reporters get training at the local level, which prepares them. Mm-hmm. And the competition, there wasn't as much competition. I think that's key to me being here.
For those just joining us, this is a special edition of Behind the Story. I'm Bill Whitaker of the Waco Tribune Herald, and we're talking with NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin, who knows everything and anything about Texas and has been in.
I don't know about that one.
Been in some.
I know like seven things, but that's it.
Pretty strange stretches. I've heard this crazy story, and it's probably not true, that you I know you were out here covering the Branch Davidian siege back in 1993.
That's right.
But is that when you began courting your wife?
No. Oh, that was much later. I actually began courting...
Well, I'm glad to hear it's not true.
I began courting my wife during the Branch Davidian civil suit, which was years later, and they had the trial here in Waco, too. And I just met my wife in Dallas, but I was spending long sections of time down here in Waco, and she would drive down to Waco to see me. And it was romance along the Brazos.
That's pretty good. Does she, I mean, you spend long periods on the road, I assume. What does she think about you being gone all the time?
Well, we do the best we can. I mean, if you think I have a demanding job, she is a pediatric intensive care unit doctor. And so it, my job pales in comparison to the kinds of things she deals with. But when something happens and I'm suddenly whisked away, it is, you know, quite the disruption to the family. We have to scramble to try to, suddenly she's on her own and, you know, taking the girls to karate and volleyball and lessons, you know. All that falls upon her, and she works 13-hour days. So, you have to have some help, which is what we do.
You were talking at the KWBU breakfast this morning about the importance of story, of that you're not a trained journalist, that you tell stories in kind of a natural chronological way, for better or for worse. I think it's for better. But when you're finding some of these interesting characters that you come across, whether it's a major story or something that's more incidental, how can you tell whether you've got a good storyteller on hand? Is there something that clicks inside you, or is it something about the person?
Well, you don't need a good storyteller to tell a good story. All you need are people who are real. And you know, it's not that often that I tell stories that will focus just on one person. Usually each one of my stories will have a cast of characters. And so you don't have to lean too heavily on the talents or abilities of any one source. You can kind of weave your sources and your sound. Sound is very important in public radio.
How does that kind of happen? I mean, like you were when you were covering the, I think the tornado wreckage in Moore, Oklahoma. You had the sirens, I think it sounded like, and the wind. And I mean, how did you get there to Moore so fast?
Well, I didn't. I mean, the funny thing about that story, I mean, it shows the kind of collaboration that is possible now in public radio that really didn't used to be possible. That tornado hit Moore, and the public and the Highway Patrol in Oklahoma immediately closed down I-35 south of and north of Moore, and the Oklahoma City Airport, Will Rogers, closed down, and I was stuck in Love Field waiting for my flight to take off so I could get to Oklahoma City. It's nighttime, but while I'm there, I'm on my laptop, I'm watching the Oklahoma City TV stations follow this tornado along in their helicopters. And I am texting with the local public radio reporters from the local station who are actually in Moore interviewing the people, and they're describing who they're talking to and what they're seeing. And so when the airport opened and I flew in, and I got to my hotel room at 1 a.m. You know, the story was all there waiting for me. I had learned, you know, a lot of it in Dallas. The other parts I had learned, you know, through the reporters in Oklahoma. And, it's a little, you know.
The sounding is,
You don't like to admit that you can report a story that you're not actually. But, you know, obviously those few moments where the tornado is passing through town, it's not so important for the reporter to be present for that. I mean, what's important is for the reporter to talk to the people who were present for that. And those people are going to be standing in front of their, you know, piles of rubble that are now their ruined homes for an hour or two or three. You've just got to figure out a way to, you know, to kind of slink past the police and get into those devastation zones where people are. And here's the other little trick on that that I've learned after many years is that if you need to get into one of these devastated places, you got to park your car and walk.
Yes.
You're never
yes,
going to make right. it with your car.
And you got to be a good walker of these
and
things.
And so, yeah, and you walk right. away from the police checkpoint, and usually there's a soft spot.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's kind of a strange craft that we're in, journalism. What's the most difficult aspect for you when covering a story? What's the one thing that you've got to kind of surmount to make it all work?
I think this is something I learned early in my career. I mean, I learned it on the Branch Davidian story, in fact. Every day we came in and we went to the convention center and got a press briefing from the FBI, our daily feeding. And it kind of made me feel like I was a White House correspondent. You know, every day I went to my little press conference.
Because that thing went on for 9 weeks.
And was told kind of what the news was. And at first, you know, my reporting was pretty one-sided. I was right on board with that Jesus, you know, in a Trans Am stuff. And part of that had to do with my own prejudices going into this. I mean, this was not long after Jonestown had happened, and I kind of took that Jonestown way of seeing in with me. And, you know, it was only because the more experienced journalists there were deeply concerned about the fact that this story was becoming way too one-sided because we couldn't talk to the Branch Davidians. That story and the way it turned out, I mean, all those people ended up dying in the fire. And then at the first anniversary of the fire, I went out to do a story, and I went out to the site. And it had become a tourist attraction now.
Yes.
And people would say to me, you know, I don't feel sorry for any of those people. I mean, I feel sorry for the children, but they should have come out. They had plenty of time. And I walked away from that day feeling pretty distraught because I really did feel like my reporting in the beginning of that story had contributed to the mindset that we found out there, which is that it didn't matter that those people had died, that there was, there was a certain element that maybe they deserved it. No one was going to feel sorry for them. And I think the hardest thing, one of the most important things, is that you've got to have some distance on what you think in this business. And that takes time to do. It takes, I think you have to be vigilant, ever vigilant, because you don't want your preconceived notions to clutter up what is going to be a great story if you will just get out of the way of it and report it straight. And I think that's the key for a good journalist.
And I know you've covered polygamist Warren Jeffs, I think it is,
that's right.
as well. Real quickly, did you see many parallels between those, the David Koresh here in the just outside Waco and the Warren Jeffs, or were those two very, very different?
No, there were parallels. I mean, I think there are parallels. I mean, whenever you get a group of believers whose beliefs are out of the mainstream. And, I mean, one of the things you learn about covering these sorts of stories is that condescending to people who don't believe the same things that you believe is not fair. And after all, it's a matter of faith. Who's to say whose faith is more on target than another's faith? Certainly, I don't think it's the job of a journalist to make those sorts of calls and to impart those sorts of judgments in the course of their reporting. So, you know, I think by the time the I'd started covering the polygamists. I had learned enough to keep my own thoughts to myself, and my own. I mean, it's not just keeping your thoughts to yourself. It's that you don't let these notions enter into the tone of your reporting. And I think I do think there was some of the same sorts of dynamics when people looked at the two groups.
For those just joining us, this is a special edition of Behind the Story. I'm Bill Whitaker with the Waco Tribune Herald, and we're talking with roving NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin. And, of course, you spent – I know you go outside beyond our state lines here in Texas, but you've spent a lot of your career focused on Texas. I think you're like one of only two people in NPR that are actually covering this state.
John Burnett is in Austin.
And so you got the rest of the state, and John's got Austin.
No. We share the state.
Oh, okay. All right. One thing I want to ask you before we cut this short, but Texas, you've covered Texas now since 1991. How has Texas changed? The state changed? How has the mindset, perhaps, of Texas? You know, my wife went to England in 1986, and everybody loved Texans. She went there in 2002. Everybody hated Texans. What has happened to our state? Have we got kind of a...
Well, some of this, I think, is a partisan reaction. I think there are some people you'll find liberals who will tend to look down upon the state, and conservatives who will tend to look up at the state and think that, you know, if I ever retire, that's the place I want to go to. I think that's a function of our political leadership. That's one of the things that changed. We've gone from Ann Richards to George Bush to Rick Perry to Abbott. And I think that's been a pretty steady rightward march all along the way. So the politics, the state's politics have gotten more conservative. I think the rise of the Tea Party has contributed to that. And I think you're going to see that play out in the upcoming state legislature. I think we're going to have the most conservative state legislature this state has had in 100 years.
Yeah, this profession has got to play havoc with your personal life. Let's just take something out of the air. Like, for instance, the explosion of a chemical plant in the nearby town of West. I mean, where were you when you got the call? How did you end up on the scene?
It's funny because I sing in a men's chorus in Dallas, and we were in dress rehearsal at the Meyerson Symphony Center we were about to open three nights of concerts, and my cell phone vibrated in my pocket. And I thought, well, that's strange. No one ever calls me at 9:30. My wife knows where I am. She wouldn't bother me. And I ignored it. And about 10 minutes later, it buzzed again. And I, you know, made my way out, tried to pick my way across two risers of singers as the artistic director shot laser beams out of his eyes at me. And I got over to the side and looked, and it was a 202 area code from Washington, D.C., and they'd called twice, and I thought,
Was it NPR?
I thought, oh, no. And I punched into Google, Texas News, and right up popped, AP urgent, massive explosion in West, dozens feared dead. And I thought, oh, no. And, that's what every journalist feels at these moments. Every one of us thinks, oh, no, and, you know, we're supposed to live for these moments, and I guess eventually we do live for these moments, but at the moment it happens, we always think,
it's a horrifying thing.
Oh, no. And your life, I mean, you run home to grab a suitcase and your equipment, and you're phoning your wife, and she's desperately trying to figure out how she's going to schedule the next week while you're doing it, and off you go.
Let me ask you something. I mean, you go all over the state, I imagine. And what is your favorite part of Texas? Is there a place? I love anything west of I-35. I mean, it could be down near the border. It could be.
That's a hard question. There are so many beautiful parts of this state. I mean, obviously, West Texas can be amazing. The Llano Estacado is amazing. Big Bend is you know, just
beautiful.
It's a and I, you know, I'm from Austin, so I love Central Texas, San Marcos, New Braunfels, San Antonio. I mean, Houston is one of the great cities of the world now, and you know, one of the most diverse places on earth. And not a whole lot of people realize that, but Houston has become, you know, and I now live in Dallas, and Dallas has become a changed place. I mean, Dallas is now second to Austin, the second bluest city in this state.
Yes, I thought I'd never see that.
If you look at, you know, the percentages of who voted for Obama, first it was Austin, and then two was Dallas. And so Dallas is, you know, changing a lot. And Waco. Waco is a place that I think, you know, you can kind of feel the momentum here when you get here. And part of that has to do with the beautiful new stadium on the river, but I think that's really just more of a symptom.
How do people view Waco outside of here? Are we still identified with the Branch Davidian crisis?
Well, you know, I think y'all can better answer that than me. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's – I mean, it would be hard for me to imagine that young people had really even heard of it.
Right.
I think passing of generations. I think for older people, some might still remember it, but you know that was a long time ago, I don't think when people think of Waco, they're still remembering David Koresh.
2015, we're right at the beginning of it now. This is January 2015. What is going to be the big story? The big stories you see coming up this year.
Well, the politics are going to be interesting. I mean, the Republican Party is, you know, absolute. I mean, the question at the national level is, can the Republican Party govern? But at the state level, the Republican Party is governing and has been governing. The question is now, you know, how is it going to play out? I mean, there are the Republican establishment, who provides a lot of the campaign financing, they very much want to see some sort of immigration reform that allows them to employ the workers they need, whether it's in agriculture or it's in hospitality, whether it's the guys on the roof building those new homes. A lot of those people are undocumented workers, and the reason those rooms are so cheap or those houses are so inexpensive is because we've got a pool of labor that is a talented pool of labor who will do things a lot more cheaply than they would do them if they were trade union members. And so part of that, you know, contributes to the affordable quality of life that we have in this state. And so you're going to see this battle between the establishment, I think, and the Tea Party as to what we're going to do. And I don't know who's going to win.
Very good. Well, listen, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Any final thoughts you have about your travels and the profession and where you're going?
No, I mean, it's I'm right in the middle of it. So
you're still enjoying it like you have?
Yes, you know, and it's a really complex craft, and so putting together public radio stories is something I'm still learning how to do.
Very good. For those who've been listening or not listening, you got here too late. This has been Behind the Story. I'm Bill Whitaker with the Waco Trib, and we've been talking with NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin, who ought to write a book someday. He just really ought to write a book someday with the adventures he's had.
Yeah, you and my wife were in perfect agreement on that one.
Anyway, we're signing off. Appreciate you listening. And Wade, thank you for coming in and talking to us.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
This program was recorded January 29th, 2015, in the KWBU studio.